This is number 0095, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, once again, this is indeed the Stuff File program, number 0095. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Leslie Choice, who is the author of How to Fix Your Head. This book is probably a send-up of other self-help books.
In some ways, I'm a person who hates self-help books, so this is a book written for people who hate self-help books. The whole point of my book is me telling funny stories about stuff that's gone wrong in my life and how I've gotten my head around having a pretty good attitude toward it. You know, I love reading about people's failures. I'm bored to death by reading books about success. So, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, setting myself up as being like the king of failures. If I can fail well and gracefully, so can you.
Anthony Del Call is on the program again. He's one of the co-creators of the comic book series Kill Shakespeare. The 12-part comic series has been very well received. Was he surprised by its success?
I didn't completely expect that. I thought that people would like the concept, they would like the series, but the reaction that we've gotten from not only people in the comic book industry, but it's also people in the Shakespeare world that, you know, I didn't know we need to be able to find somebody, diehard closeted Shakespeare fans and get them out to read the book.
James Rick is the author of Unleash Your Full Potential, The Secret for Revealing Your Hidden Power. He shares some insight into the advantages of working from home.
Companies don't have to pay for office overhead. They don't have to pay for miscellaneous office supplies. And individuals that are already paying for a house, that are already paying for the internet, that would normally have to pay for the gas in the car to do the commute, and pay in terms of time, getting ready for work and commuting to work. These are all productivity losses that can be channeled into productivity gains for both companies and for individuals.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0095, is Virgil Aline, who is an employee with Bombardier in Toronto. He is also the husband of my niece, Cheryl, and the father of Jordan and D'Amica, and also an all-around cool dude. Thank you very much, Virgil, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, in Memphis, Tennessee, you might say 48-year-old Joseph Hayes took the concept of overreaction to an entirely new level. Hayes was arrested after he allegedly threatened the host of a child's birthday party with a gun because his own kids didn't get any ice cream or cake. Wow. According to a police affidavit, Hayes became upset and began yelling at the victim because y'all didn't save my kids no damn ice cream and cake, unquote. He then left the party and went to his apartment, returned with a small black handgun tucked into his pants. Allegedly, he approached the host, lifted his shirt, and said, "I ain't scared to go to jail, just take care of my kids." The host then called police, saying she was in fear for her life. After being arrested, Hayes told police he didn't bring a gun to the party, just an object that looked like one when tucked in his pants. And there's your Marie Antoinette moment for you. I love the quote, by the way, "I ain't scared to go to jail, just take care of my kids." Well, geez, I mean, who's going to take care of these kids when this idiot does go to jail? That's what I want to know. Moving right along, hey, New Jersey folks, let's all try to remember to be patient with our barbers, okay? In Trenton, New Jersey, 40-year-old barber James Dillard got himself arrested after allegedly biting a customer's ear in half after a dispute over how long a haircut was taking. Dillard works at Beauty and the Beast Barbershop, I guess he's the Beast, and was cutting the hair of a 24-year-old man. The customer began complaining about how slowly Dillard was cutting his hair and ultimately decided to get up and leave the shop. The customer slammed the barbershop's front door on the way out so hard, by the way, that it caused the glass in it to shatter. That sent Mr. Dillard running outside after the guy, where the two began to fight. During the struggle, Dillard bit the customer's ear nearly in half. The ear remained attached to the guy's head, and he was rushed to the hospital. Dillard was arrested and charged with aggravated assault. Wow. Shave and a haircut, ear in two bits. And while parents have been embarrassing their teenagers for generations, an American Fork, Utah father of a 16-year-old has turned it into an art form. The 16-year-old, his name is Rain Price, his father is Dale Price, and Dale has been embarrassing his boy every single morning for an entire school year. When the high school's bus routes changed this year, the Prices found out that it would be going right past their house each morning. That's when Rain's father got an idea. Mr. Price got a wonderfully awful idea. Every single morning, Dale would stand in his front yard waving at the bus dressed in a different costume. Rain says, "When he did it the first day, I was in shock. It's my first day of my sophomore year." But the embarrassment was a thrill for his father. The second day of school, there he was again. Only this time, Dale was wearing a San Diego Chargers helmet and jersey. Day three, it was an Anakin Skywalker helmet. And the next day, swim trunks and a snorkel mask. Over the year, Dale has been Batgirl, the Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz, Elvis, the Little Mermaid, Princess Leia, Nacho Libre, Santa Claus, and more. Dale admits it took a lot of effort to keep it up, but he said it was, quote, a way of letting him know that we really care about him. He described it as a father's way of saying I love you. Rain even admits that now the kids on the bus all look forward to seeing what his father is going to be dressed up as next, as he never repeated a costume, and they all smile and wave from the bus. But fortunately for Rain, Dale said 1 year is enough. Next year, he said, I'm going to sleep in, no alarm, not getting out of bed. You know, it sounds like an odd story, but it really is touching to see. And you can check out his blog, by the way, and see the pictures and read his story. The blog is waveatthebus.blogspot.com. And of course, I'm going to put a link into it from my website at thestufffile.com so you can check it out. It's kind of touching, kind of sweet, kind of nice. Not that odd as it sounds. Take a peek. Anyway, one more story in the Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. How disgusting is this? Apparently, citizens in Connecticut have forgotten what a toilet looks like. Officials in New London, Connecticut, had to turn off the water at the city's new waterfront fountain because people kept using it as a toilet. The fountain was turned on last month and features a sculpture of a whale's tail with water spilling over it, which visitors are encouraged to run through. However, since it opened, police have been bombarded by calls reporting people urinating, defecating, and showering in the fountain water. City Manager Denise Rose says police are developing a plan to better keep an eye on the area. All I have to say to that story is, ick. Ooh. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Leslie Choice is the author of How to Fix Your Head. It's a collection of anecdotes that could be considered a send-up of traditional self-help books. He joins us on the line from Nova Scotia. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, great to be here.
Looking at your overachieving bio... It sounds like you do more things than most people do in the beginning of their day. I mean, for instance, you've written 70 books. I know people who haven't read 70 books.
Well, they're not all great books. They're just books, right?
Okay. So tell us about How to Fix Your Head. As I said, it's sort of like a send-up to some traditional self-help books, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think, you know, in some ways I'm a person who hates self-help books, so this is a book written for people who hate self-help books. The whole point of my book is me telling funny stories about stuff that's gone wrong in my life and how I've gotten my head around having a pretty good attitude toward it. So, you know, as soon as I hear myself talking, I say, I hate those self-help book authors. Now I'm actually one of them, and I'm sounding like a guy who knows what he's talking about. But the stories are entertaining. You know, it's really fun to read about things that go wrong in other people's lives. You know, I love reading about people's failures. I'm bored to death by reading books about success. So, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, setting myself up as being like the king of failures. If I can fail well and gracefully, so can you.
Do you think that's part of the key to your success? Because I think sometimes people are afraid to fail.
Oh, absolutely. Somewhere, you know, I remember back, you know, me sitting in like grade six somewhere and sitting kind of scared of the world, afraid I'm going to be embarrassed. You know, if I try something, I can't do it. People laugh at me. I wish I knew then, and I wish every kid today knows that, you know, all that stuff is very, very trivial and unimportant. You know, the point is to get out there and you know, try things that you love to do or try things that you think you're not capable of doing. If you fall flat on your face, you know, get up, look around. You know, people are going to smile or smirk or whatever for a minute, and they're going to forget about it. And you're free then to do whatever you want. So I kind of learned that from surfing, you know, failing gracefully, you know, falling off my board, wiping out. You know, in my case, it's often surfing in the winter in Nova Scotia, air temperature minus 20, water temperature below zero. So you really pay for your failures. It hurts. But from that, I learned to, you know, take it out into the world and just have fun with stuff. And if, you know, if I'm a bozo and somebody laughs at me, who cares? Because, you know, I'm getting to live my life more fully.
I was going to bring up the surfing. I mean, do people in your neighborhood say, oh, there goes that adventurous noise again, or they're simply, there goes noise again?
Well, you know, it used to be that people thought I was a bit on the crazy side because there's only a handful of us surfing in the winter in Nova Scotia. Now there's, you know, well over 100 plus people who surf right through the winter. And it's become a kind of a standard sort of thing. So what was once, you know, my private insanity is now, you know, something that's become popular in Nova Scotia. You know, hey, we're Canadians, we've got an ocean, we've got good waves, so, you know, we surf in the winter. Like, I'm not the best surfer in the world, but I'm probably surfing some of the coldest conditions.
Now, one of the things I see in the bio, which has me a bit concerned about this book, Skunk Whisperer?
Yes. Yes, well, this, you know, the inspiration from this, you know, was the fact that I had 13 skunks living under my house. You know, it's an old, really old farmhouse, loose stone foundation, a bit of a crawl space. You know, woke up one morning back when my kids were young, and, you know, this horrendous smell reeking through the house. Oh, my God, what's that? So it turned out some skunk had sort of gotten invaded by a cat and gone wham. Whole house smelled like skunk really bad. Had to catch this skunk, but didn't want to kill him. So, you know, bought a Have-A-Heart trap. You know, I'm an environmentally friendly guy. Caught the skunk, drove him 15 kilometers away, because skunks will return. They're homing skunks. And turned out there was not one skunk, but 13. So I had to catch them one at a time, over and over. And there's all this weird, you know, family stuff happening. And, you know, one day I'm flying on an airplane to Toronto, smelling like skunk. And the pilot actually decides not to take off on the runway because he says to everybody on the plane, I'm sorry, we have a very unusual smell on the plane, we have to solve this problem. Turned out it was me sitting in an airplane seat smelling like skunk. You know, so this very large story evolved, turned it into a chapter in a book. I did a kid's book, did a documentary I sold to three networks called The Skunk Whisperer, that's me, and realized that, you know, these things that go wrong in your life, at least for a writer, a creative person, they're gold. You know, those are the nuggets that we're mining.
You must have had a mother who said, make lemonade out of lemons.
Not really. I think I'm, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, you know, I have to admit, immigrated to Canada in 1978. But, you know, the one thing about growing up in New Jersey is it's kind of like a balls to the wall kind of state, right? You know, Jersey doesn't have a very good reputation. You know, it was once beautiful, and it turned into this, you know, industrial nightmare. And, you know, it gives you an attitude. So I didn't like that particular American New Jersey attitude I had. So part of my, you know, therapy was moving to Nova Scotia, where people are kind and gentle and compassionate and humble. And, of course, becoming a Canadian, which for the most part includes, you know, all those descriptive words. And that kind of mellowed me out. But I did hold on to a little bit of that attitudinal stuff that comes from Jersey.
Well, it must have been culture shock from New Jersey to Nova Scotia.
Oh, absolutely. But it was like, you know, it's like moving to heaven. I basically came here with no money, wanting to be a writer, starting to, you know, write my books. I bought a little old house for $14,900 overlooking the ocean. And, you know, proceeded to, you know, kind of carve out a life. It's, you know, the one thing I found about Nova Scotia in particular, Canada in general, is that you can be a bit more self-reliant. You can be a little more, you know, independent, you know, and kind of carve your own path the way that you want to do it. And, you know, as you know from the eccentricities in the book, that's, you know, I just fit in just fine here on the eastern shore of Nova Scotia.
Do you think that a lot of people take life a little too seriously, even here in Canada?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, I put a few challenging things in this book that, you know, probably are going to tick some people off. For example, I'm opposed to perfectionism. I think it makes people really, really unhappy. You know, be a slob, be imperfect, make all the mistakes, do that kind of stuff. Your fears, they're there for a purpose. You know, you're afraid for a reason, so don't ignore them, but embrace your fears. The one chapter I think people will really think that I'm totally nuts of, I wrote a chapter in favor of taxes. I'm so happy that I live in one of the highest taxed countries in the world, you know, because every time governments start chopping taxes, they take it away from old people, they take stuff away from kids, they ruin education and health care. And the higher the taxes you pay, if you look at the nations in the world, the truth is they're the best countries in the world to live in. So, you know, when I hear people complain about taxes, I'm this big defender of it, which I know, you know, that probably I can see people clenching their fists already.
Well, I'm going to surprise you. That's one thing that you and I completely agree upon.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
I also believe if I earn it, I pay my share fair.
Yeah, it doesn't feel so bad, you know. I especially when it goes to, like, health care here, and obviously coming from the States, you know, we didn't have that. So, you know, some good stuff gets done. But I express it in the book a little bit, you know, kind of in, you know, in coalition with all those other things. Like, you know, taxes seem bad, but they're actually good for you. Bad weather seems uncomfortable, but it actually builds character. And, you know, those really crappy jobs that we all have when we're young, that's one of the best things that you can do is have, you know, really, really bad jobs and then move on.
Hmm. Well, when people think of taxes, they also link it with death. I don't understand. You have a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, I thought it was probably, as I reread the book, and this is, strangely enough, this book, despite all the others I've written, this one was 10 years in the making. I've just been working at it for a long time. I guess the only, you know, real upside for death, you know, if we're talking about you or me, is that, you know, when you die, I don't think it's that bad. I'm not sure what happens, but I think it's probably pretty much okay for the person who dies. I think it's really, there's a lot of, obviously, sadness and grief and loss and hurt, you know, for the people who remain alive. But, you know, I don't think there's much point in being afraid of death itself. So I think that frees you up a little bit, too. Not that you know, you have to be, you know, out doing wild and crazy, dangerous things. But I think if, you know, if you look at death as, you know, just, you know, the next step to somewhere, even if you don't know where you're going, I think that allows you to live life a little bit better.
I think this book should be in every office underneath the glass in case of emergency, you know, break glass. It sounds like the perfect antidote to so many things.
Yes, yeah. I agree.
The book is called How to Fix Your Head. It's written by Leslie Choice. And Leslie, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much. And to you and your listeners, remember, embrace your failures.
Leslie Choice, author of How to Fix Your Head. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0095, and you'll find links to Leslie's website, plus links to amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll have a return visit of one of the co-creators of Kill Shakespeare. And we'll meet James Rick, author of Unleash Your Full Potential, The Secret for Revealing Your Hidden Power. We'll talk a little bit about working from home. Plus, of course, we have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news. As a matter of fact, we have Stuff File news right here. Right now, it appears some teenagers will do just about anything to get their hands on a new iPad, and we do mean anything. In China, a 17-year-old boy sold one of his kidneys so that he could buy the new iPad 2. No kidding. The boy, identified only as Zhang, responded to an online advertisement offering cash to organ donors. After negotiations, the boy traveled to the city of Shenzhou in Hunan province, where the kidney was removed at a local hospital. He was paid $4,000. The boy, who suffered complications following the surgery, returned home, but was unable to keep what he had done from his mother. His mother said, "When he came back, he had a laptop and a new Apple iPad, and I wanted to know how he got so much money," and he finally confessed that he had sold one of his kidneys. Well, the mother took the son back to Shenzhou to report the crime to the police. However, the cell phones of all three agents that Zhang had contacted were all switched off. The hospital, which admitted contracting out its urology department to a private businessman, denied any knowledge of the surgery. So that's it. No traces of who has the kidney. So he paid a kidney for a new iPad. Well, at least it didn't cost him an arm and a leg. Meanwhile, you know you're really drunk when you call the police to report that your wife fell overboard from your sailboat because you forgot that your wife didn't even go sailing with you. It happened in Kalmar, Sweden. Rescue crews combed the area after a sailor said he feared his wife had fallen from his sailboat and drowned, but they soon learned that our friend was simply stinking drunk and that his wife was safely at home. The rescue team towed the boat back to shore and police administered a breath test confirming the man was intoxicated. He was then arrested for drunk boating. Now, you know, at home, this could go either way. His wife could be furious with him at his drunken stupidity, or she could say that since he thought that she was with him and fell overboard, that his quick call to the police showed that he really loved her. Of course, a complete cynic would say perhaps he was drunk and having an affair, and his girlfriend is the one who ended up in the water, and there's no trace of her. Nah, that's too negative. Anyway, moving right along, some people will go to some pretty bizarre lengths to steal from others. Police in Spain have arrested a man they say is a contortionist and hid inside a suitcase in order to steal from tourist luggage. Basically, the guy would contort his way into a suitcase and would then get loaded by a friend onto the luggage compartment of a bus going from Girona Airport to Barcelona. He would then get out of the suitcase and search the rest of the luggage for valuables before returning to the case. But he was busted by a passerby who grew suspicious. Police opened the suitcase and found the man doubled up inside. When asked what he was doing, the man, who was wearing a headlamp, at first said he was simply a stowaway who couldn't afford bus fare. But then they found sharp tools used for opening zips and locks, as well as a small bag of valuables and a mobile phone. So our friend and his accomplice, both Polish citizens, were arrested. Okay, I know it's a crime. I know he should go to jail. I'm all for sending him off to jail because, you know, you do the crime, you do the time. But you gotta kind of admire the ingenuity of this one, don't you? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest with me, Peter Anthony Holder, if you live in Watertown, New York, or anywhere around that area and the Jefferson County area, don't be alarmed if you see a man and his mannequin traveling along Route 11 and into the city. That's just 38-year-old Ned Neffer, who is traveling from Syracuse to Watertown by foot and pushing a wheelchair that sits Tegan, a 6-foot mannequin that Ned claims is his wife. Ned says he was born in Syracuse and in the 1980s spent some time at the Children's Home of Jefferson County in Watertown, where he said he met Tegan when she was just a head. He says he then built a body for her and the two were married October 31st, 1986, in California. Sure, he can marry a mannequin in California, just not a same-sex one. Anyway, Jefferson County Sheriff John P. Burns said a deputy responded to a call about Ned, but he was not taken into custody and is not deemed a threat. Lisa Spear, principal social welfare examiner of the Jefferson County Department of Social Services, says she also had a talk with Nick, and she says, "This is definitely one of the very oddest things I've ever come across, but he seems very happy. I wouldn't classify him as dangerous at all. He seems quite happy in his own little world." Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? You know, last year around this time, we had Anthony Del Call on the program. He is one of the creators, along with Connor McCreary, of Kill Shakespeare, which is a 12-part comic book series featuring Shakespeare's most famous heroes. So here we are, close to the end of the 12 parts, and I thought it would be interesting to have Anthony back on the show. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Peter. I'm glad to be back.
Glad to have you back. So, near the end of the series, but I get the feeling, because it's been pretty successful, I get the feeling it's not the end completely for you guys.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Kill Shakespeare is not getting killed, if you will, anytime soon. As you said, I mean, issue number 12 is due to come out in late July, early August. That's the end of the initial run for Kill Shakespeare's a comic book series. But we are interested in continuing the series based on the very positive reaction that we've had from fans, from critics, and from the publisher as well, has also expressed interest. So we're excited about the possibility, but nothing's in place right now. And then in addition to the comic series, we're also looking at expanding the brand and our story into other mediums, a.k.a. Mobile game or apps, and the screenplay as well.
Were you surprised by the success that you've had with this, or did you anticipate the audience that you've got?
A little bit surprised. I mean, we knew that this was a winning concept. As soon as we came up with the idea 8 years ago, we thought, wow, this is one of those concepts that is so rare to find and would be universal. That university would be liked. But in terms of the actual reception that we received, no. I mean, because for the most part, especially over the last few months with the last few issues, I mean, everything we read about and everything we're receiving is all acclaim. I didn't completely expect that. I thought that people would like the concept, they would like the series, but the reaction that we've gotten from not only people in the comic book industry, but it's also people in the Shakespeare world that, you know, I didn't know we'd be able to find somebody, diehard closeted Shakespeare fans and get them out to read the book.
Well, that's one thing I know I asked you at the time we had you on last year, and I'll bring that question up again. Was there ever a concern, or did you ever hear from the so-called Shakespeare purists?
Yes, we have. I mean, last year, I'm sure I talked about that. There was one very nasty review of issue number one by a Shakespeare scholar based out of New York. Kimberly Cox is her name. She's also the girlfriend of Frank Miller, who created 300 and Sin City, amongst other huge comic book series in the past. But, I mean, she just absolutely disliked the first issue. But the only thing that she actually mentioned, not liking specifically, was that we did not write it in iambic pentameter. But for the most part, we have our own Shakespeare purists, but not that many. For the most part, people have seen Shakespeare in so many different interpretations and so many adaptations, whether it's a modernist take on it, a manga take on it, an animated take on it, with different characters, different switching of sexes and genres. that, I mean, I think people are really open to it. And a lot of the really die-hard Shakespeare fans and theater geeks that we talk to, I mean, they just love the fact that, you know, it's a bold, unique take on Shakespeare and his characters.
The thing that's I find so interesting, if there's anybody who's against the concept, is the fact that Shakespeare in his day was such a populist, and he used what was available to him at that time and would probably do the same today.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Hamlet, for instance, you know, often people state that Hamlet is his greatest production and perhaps one of the greatest plays or stories of all time. That wasn't actually an original conception. That was based on, I think, a Norse mythological tale. He just kind of adapted it and put his own little spin on it. And yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do with Kill Shakespeare. We're taking all of his greatest heroes and villains and putting them all together in a very unique and original story. And yeah, as you said, I mean, Shakespeare was a mass performer. I mean, we often might say that he was the James Cameron or the Stan Lee of his time. Where, I mean, he would do whatever, you know, he wanted to entertain not only the highbrow and the intellectuals and academics, the royalty up in their own private balconies, but the average person that would play pay a ducat or two and have to stand in the mud and watch his shows. And everyone would be equally entertained.
Now, when you started this project, did you plot the whole thing out? In other words, you have 12 issues to fill out the entire story. Did you know exactly where those 12 issues were going when you started, or did it develop or change over the course of the year?
We knew from the beginning what would happen. We knew all the major plot points. We knew what would happen in issue number 12. We knew how the series, this initial run, would end. However, there have been some small changes along the way, and that's what's great about the comic book medium and also about the fans and the readers. I mean, as the first few issues came out, we started to hear some sort of feedback. You know, for the most part, people would say, yeah, this is really, really good, but then they would mention something small. Oh, you know, the these and the thous aren't 100% correct. Or, you know, some small things on dialogue, or a couple things on sort of the small characters. So we've actually been able to adapt, you know, some of the smaller parts of our story moving on, which is what makes the comic book medium so great. I mean, because unlike most... comic book readers, as soon as they read something, they like to talk about it. They like to talk about it in person, and they like to talk about it online, whether it's on message board, email, on Facebook. And so it's always great to read these sorts of this sort of feedback, because it really does come back to us and allow us to adapt and sculpt the story moving forward.
With the 12th issue soon to come out, after all is said and done, do you anticipate reissuing all 12 in some sort of larger graphic novel altogether?
Yes, we do. I mean, the first six have already been collected in a trade paperback, which was released in early November. The second six, issues 7 to 12, will be released at the end of October. And then, yeah, we do have interest in doing an omnibus, as we like to call it, an omnibus edition, where we collect issues 1 through 12 all in one. And it could be soft cover. It might even be hardcover. It's all stuff that we're working on with the publisher at the moment.
Now, I got in contact with you again because, and I send this out as a warning to other interviewers, once you interview you guys, there's no escaping. But I called you after getting your plethora of emails as to what you guys had been up to, and when trying to call you, we couldn't get a schedule to do this interview because you were so busy working on a script. So what's happening there?
You're absolutely right, yes. I mean, even before our first issue came out last April, we were approached by a number of Hollywood film companies very interested in the film rights. And Connor, my co-creator Connor McCreary, and I have a background in film and television here in Canada. And so we really wanted to play a major role in a film version of it. So it took us forever just because it takes up so much time, just not only creating the comic book series and overseeing all the creative, but also all the marketing. As you said, I mean, we're quite voracious. I mean, we're shameless self-promoters. We want everyone to know about Bill Shakespeare. But I mean, now we've been able to block out some time to work on the screenplay, and more importantly, we're also getting some great reactions from the Canadian industry here. And so, of late, we've been able to secure financing to work on the screenplay from Telefilm Canada, the Harold Greenberg Fund, and the Horse Made with Pay Fund. Which is only going to enhance it because it would be so easy for us just to sell the property to someone in Hollywood and then they might sit on it, nothing may happen, or even worse, they may make something that we're not very happy with or proud of. So we want to play that active role. We know we're not going to drive the bus, but we want a nice seat on the bus as we move forward into a film version.
You've been going to, I understand, various trade shows, Comic-Con, things like that. How's the reception been when you've gone to events like that?
I have spent time in the film industry. I've been in TV, and then I've been in music. And comic book conventions are probably the favorite thing, the thing that I enjoy doing the most out of all in all of these industries, just because in no other place do you have that sort of instant feedback. Where, I mean, someone will come up and say, hey, you know, I read the first issue, or I read, you know, the first trade paperback, and I really liked it. I like this. I like that. It's a very open, friendly environment. Where, I mean, an average person can just go into one of these conventions, and before you know it, you're having a conversation with the top creator. It's a very laid-back, relaxed attitude and atmosphere, which is great for creators. And for us, I mean, it's fantastic because despite the fact that we have been, you know, shameless self-promoters of the project, there's still a lot of people that aren't familiar with it because it is an indie title. I mean, we're not Batman, we're not Spider-Man or Iron Man, you know, we're still Shakespeare. So it gives us that opportunity for individuals that come to see the creator, you know, an artist that does Spider-Man or Wolverine or something, and then they walk by our table, they're like, "Kill Shakespeare." Whoa, you know, I've kind of liked Shakespeare in the past, and we tell them the concept, and it's such an easy sell because for the most part, you know, people are fans of Shakespeare even if they don't even realize it.
Well, I was going to end off by saying what you've done. Thanks for making Shakespeare cool again. But the reality is, for most of us, and I say, you know, the general population who weren't necessarily Shakespeare readers, Shakespeare was always cool. It was just us that weren't hip to the room.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, whether it's a 15-year-old student who's just struggling in school, we've had people that have contacted us after reading Kill Shakespeare and go and tell us, well, now that I read Kill Shakespeare, now I get Juliet. Now I understand Hamlet. And get them excited. And also, I mean, on the flip side, I mean, we're also getting a lot of Shakespeare fans who have never really been big into comic books. They read Kill Shakespeare, and then they go, wow, this comic medium is actually pretty cool. I would have thought it was for kids. But now I see there's some really interesting stories, so they ask us for suggestions. So that's the best thing, to make comic book fans out of Shakespeare fans and vice versa.
Wow, bringing those two worlds together. Now, if you can just figure out that Middle East problem, everything will be fine.
I'm sure Shakespeare, I'm sure somewhere in all the plays of Shakespeare, I'm sure the solution lies there. We just haven't found it yet.
Anthony, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
No problem. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
Anthony Del Call, one of the creators of Kill Shakespeare. You can check out their website at www.killshakespeare.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0095, and you'll find links to Anthony's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you heard the story about the guy who sued Winnebago over its cruise control? According to the story, he set the cruise control while driving his RV and then left his seat to brew some coffee. Of course, he crashed, and as the story goes, he was mad that the instructions didn't warn him not to do this, so he sued. If you've heard this, you're not alone. It's part of a widely distributed email note about five crazy lawsuits that received the so-called Stella Awards, named after the woman who spilled coffee on herself and then sued McDonald's. The problem is, all the stories are fake. Yes, urban legends. It's easy to believe them, though, because so many real lawsuits are just as outrageous. Let's be fair, there's a better place to get information about how junk lawsuits are affecting America than through phony emails. To get the facts, visit our website at centerforamerica.org. The information we have is verified by careful research and proves once again that truth is indeed stranger than fiction.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about working from home. Plus, of course, we do have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news before we get to all that right here, right now. A couple of cow stories, or cow-related stories anyway. In England, the folks who make Laughing Cow Cheese decided to generate a little publicity by hiring comedian Milton Jones to perform stand-up to a field of cows in an experiment to see if cows have a sense of humor. They set up a big stage with lights and sound system. Jones was joined by cow expert Bruce Woodacre from the Hertfordshire Farm as he performed a special set of visual and verbal jokes called Pull the Udder One. Get it? Pull the Udder One? Anyway, Woodacre monitored the cow's reaction. Gags included, "So you cows say you're vegetarians, but how come you all wear leather, huh?" Yeah. And went to one of those farmer's markets the other day, bought a couple of farmers, should taste lovely. Okay. Jones said writing comedy for cows was very different, but a comedian plays to his audience, so I wrote new material to really get under their hides. Woodacre, who has studied cow behavior for more than 40 years, said happy cows are more productive, and there's a chance we've stumbled across something here. Most of the herd crowded closely around the stage and jostled for a good position. They had their mouths open and their ears laid back, indicating that they were relaxed and content. But he added, not everyone was entertained, though. I definitely heard some low heckling moos, and there were even a few walkouts. Okay, anyway, I've spent 20 years working at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, and I'm also the host of the Just for Laughs XM satellite radio show on Laugh Attack XM 153, so I can't wait to tell some of the comedians I come across each and every year about the potential new audience that will await them if they write new material for cows. Yeah. Okay, while we're talking about cattle, while petty jealousy is never an attractive quality, 34-year-old Christina Cantu apparently has a serious problem with it. In Greeley, Colorado, Miss Cantu allegedly got into a fight with her live-in boyfriend, Fernando Rodriguez, after she came home and became angry at him for paying more attention to a sick calf than her. She then accused him of not being in love with her anymore. Rodriguez said that's when Cantu went into the kitchen and grabbed a knife and started coming at him, saying that she would kill him this time. This time? She's pulled a knife before? Anyway, he fled to the bathroom, where he said Cantu kicked and stabbed at the door, breaking the blade in the process. She later left the house at Rodriguez's request. He called police, and now she's been charged with felony, menacing, and misdemeanor criminal mischief. As far as we know, the calf is okay. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Is the idea of working from home a good fit for you? If so, how do you go about doing it? What's the best plan of action? Well, James Rick is the founder and CEO of Global Sky and the host of The Full Potential Show. He's also the author of Unleash Your Full Potential, The Secret for Revealing Your Hidden Power. He joins us online from Las Vegas. Hi, James.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being with us. So the idea of working at home is attractive to a lot of people, but can it be practically done?
Well, absolutely, Peter. I think what you're seeing in the world today is the downsizing of corporations and an old way of doing business and the upsizing of entrepreneurs. You know, many of the home employed or many of the small-time entrepreneurs today make up the largest percentage of employers, and you're just seeing the tail skip in that direction.
Now, I remember back in 1996, when Atlanta was getting the Olympics that year, and I remember then that many companies tried to start telecommuting because they were concerned about the gridlock around the time that the Olympics was taking place, and one of the byproducts, I understand, of that project was that some of the people who were staying at home to work while the Olympics were on never went back to the office.
Well, is that due to them just never wanting to go back, or they found that it worked well?
I think it's a little bit of both.
What I think you'll find is, even especially since the time of the Olympics, is that technology is continuing to improve, and the advantages of working from home are being discovered. Now, whether it's, you know, in situations like that where, you know, there's a bit of an experiment and they discover that it works out the same, if not better, from them working from home, you know, you will find that more and more companies, especially during times like now where you've got a recession and companies need to cut back and save money and still have the same amount of productivity. If you look at it from an economical standpoint, companies don't have to pay for office overhead. They don't have to pay for miscellaneous office supplies. And individuals that are already paying for a house, that are already paying for the internet, that would normally have to pay for the gas in the car to do the commute and pay in terms of time, getting ready for work and commuting to work. These are all productivity losses that can be channeled into productivity gains for both companies and for individuals.
Okay, so you've listed a whole set of advantages for somebody who is working at home, either on an entrepreneurial basis or for a company. There's got to be some downsides, though. Not everything can be all completely rosy, and there might be some people who might not best be suited for working at home. So let's weed those out first.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, for example, at least in today's environment, I don't know if I'd want a doctor working on me remotely. I don't know if I would want... some of the face-to-face interactions that need to happen, you know, if you're a massage therapist or something like that, obviously working from home in the sense of being able to remotely commute into work is not going to happen. But for a lot of entrepreneurs, especially where we're entering, you know, this knowledge age, the information age, the digital age, and a lot of work is being done in front of the computer or over the telephone, virtually all of those kind of occupations can be done remotely. You literally have ways now to monitor what a person is doing as a company. You don't need them in the same office to be able to monitor, to be able to collaborate. And so there, as I mentioned before, there's obvious productivity gains both for companies and for individuals. But certainly, yeah, there is going to be some downsides if you're not using those monitoring controls or if you aren't using the collaboration tools that you have available. Or if you have somebody who finds ways to abuse those tools, but you're going to have, you know, the downside from working from home, you're going to have similar downsides if you look at it in the office, people who abuse break time or sick leaves and vacation leaves. And there's also the added benefit here if you can build a contractor relationship with entrepreneurs, you know, people working from home and the companies that are contracting them as opposed to being employees, not only can the entrepreneurs working from home have greater flexibility, but then there's also tax advantages because literally they can become incorporated and companies themselves can avoid the payroll tax normally associated with hiring employees. So there's also tax advantages on both ends for doing it this way.
Well, let's look at the pros and cons of the time factor. The pro being that you can probably set your own hours and get your work done as long as your work gets done. The con side being that sometimes when you live at home and it's also your work spot, you don't necessarily get away from work.
That's definitely true. And in that scenario, what you've got to look at is you've got to have either an extra room that you can allocate to doing this kind of thing or basically a work environment that you can cut off from outside distraction. Because definitely now you have to think more in terms of controlling your home environment and temporarily converting it into a work environment. And you also have to get into the mindset of, I'm going to work now. You know, I joke sometimes when I'm doing work here at the house and I say, okay, I'm going to work now. See you later. Bye-bye. See you when you get back. And I just go into the next room. But it really does have to be that kind of a flip of the switch to make the transition from, all right, I'm at home, and everybody knows that, you know, this is where we hang out and we live, to now I'm in work mode, and this is where I'm going to do my work today.
Even if you can wrap your head around that and compartmentalize your home life and work life, which is something I'm guessing you need to do to make it successful, the other fly in the ointment are other people who aren't on necessarily the same page. What if I'm one of your close friends and I'm going, oh, God, you know, I could just drop by over at James's place or give him a call. He's at home.
You have to set the standards early. I don't have that problem because my friends and my family, they understand that when I'm, you know, in work mode or I'm working, that's what I'm doing. Now, I'm also not very rude about it. I mean, the nature of the work that I do, I can pick up and I can take a break and I you know, for 5 or 10 minutes or 15 minutes or, you know, 30 minutes and go out to the park. And just, again, it comes back to, do you have the kind of work where you need the continuity? In other words, are you needing to be in front of the phone for 8 hours because you're doing a customer service shift? Or is it a kind of work where it's results-oriented, which I believe is also the trend for many entrepreneurs. It's all results-oriented work unless you need to be there during specific time slots. And if it's results-oriented, then not only do you need to compartmentalize in a way that says, I'm at work now, this is what I'm doing, but you also need to be very priority oriented and say, as long as I'm getting these things done, I'm not going to kill myself trying to work around the clock. Just because I'm home and this is a work environment doesn't mean I need to do it all the time, and doesn't mean that I need to lose sight of my social environment. So I think you can balance, and that's one of the things I talk about a lot on fullpotential.com, is really balancing the seven major areas of life so that you don't neglect any one part, but you also don't focus too much on one part to the neglect of others.
Who best grasps this idea of working from home? The office scenario, the company, the boss, or the potential employee who's working at home? Who better gets it?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, what you have to do from a company standpoint, like, for example, my other business I have is called Outbounders.com. And what we do is we offer companies the ability to get lead generation and appointment setting done by people who work from home using our call center technology. So at Outbounders.com, they go to the site and they can pick the agents that they actually want to work with. And once they see the cost advantage, you know, I say, look, well, with this kind of service, it's $6 an hour, as opposed to I have an office in Manila and it's $9 an hour. If you want to go with the office, it's going to be this much, about 30% more. And if you want to go with the virtual agents, it's this much. Now, I can tell you, and I've been having these calls now for months, 8 times out of 10, they will say to me, I'm like, gosh, as long as I can monitor and do everything I want to do with them working from home, I would prefer to have them working from home. It's almost like they haven't ever been introduced to the option, and the pieces haven't been put in place so that it can be done as effectively, and you can educate them on that. But once companies see the advantage, they are on board. They love it. And then B, of course, the entrepreneurs working from home absolutely love it, because they know that they're only getting paid for the time they work, but they also know they have the freedom if they need to take a child to school or an emergency comes up. It's not like they're stuck in the rigorous bureaucracy of a company in the office. They can literally pick up, do what they need to do, come back, and they know that they're paid for the time that's worked. They love the flexibility.
Okay, same question of who gets it more. From the entrepreneur point of view, who gets it more, men or women?
Ooh, you know what? I don't know if there's a gender specific on who gets it more. I think really it appeals to both men and women. But, you know, if I had to lean in one direction or another, I'd say definitely women as mothers that are looking for a way to contribute to the household and still be able to raise kids and be there. Because, you know, mothers can't bring their kids to the workplace. And most often, you know, we women are the nurturers. I think women are generally better at nurturing kids than men. You know, so I think that both parents are essential, but a woman being able to be around her children and nurture them on more of a full-time basis without feeling like she's outsourcing mothering to a caretaker while she's working, that definitely appeals to women, to be able to work from home and still be able to take care of their kids.
The book is called Unleash Your Full Potential. The website is fullpotential.com. And James, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Absolutely, Peter. I encourage everybody who is aspiring to be an entrepreneur or work with entrepreneurs, this is the future, and I'm glad that you're out there making it aware for people to access and really make a change in their life to do it. So thank you, Peter.
James Rick, author of Unleash Your Full Potential, The Secret for Revealing Your Hidden Power. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0095, and you'll find links to James's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Police say masked and armed men in Cape Cod thought they were nabbing a bag of dough. They did, just not the kind they wanted. Three Hyannis men are facing armed robbery while masked charges after police say they robbed a Dunkin' Donuts with knives and a hatchet and only ended up with, well, a bag of donuts. According to police, the men demanded a paper bag that was in one of the workers' purses, mistakenly believing she was carrying cash from the day's receipts. but police say the men never looked inside. The men were captured on video and police were able to track them down. Not the brightest trio. Okay, let's look at this from different levels. First, cops frequent donut shops. I'm not making any kind of joke here. It's just a reality because donut shops have copious amounts of coffee and they're usually open 24 hours. That's why cops go there. So don't rob them, or at least try to rob them. Second, if you insist on being that dumb and you pull off a heist, doesn't it make sense that you'd look into the bag to see what you're actually stealing to make sure that it's, you know, money? This just proves that these guys are idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0095. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0095. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags and mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.